Hello, my name is Daniel Morden and I am a storyteller. Between 2018 and 2021, I will be a visiting fellow at the George Ewart Evans Centre for Storytelling at the University of South Wales. During that period, I intend to make a series of podcasts, each of which will be an interview. This is the first of those interviews. I'm pleased to say it is with an author who's been an inspiration to me ever since I was a child, Alan Garner. My thanks to him and his wife Griselda for making me so welcome in their home. And also, my thanks go to Steve Johnson at the university for helping me so much with the technical aspects of making this podcast. Here we go. Alan, who would you say was the first storyteller in your life?
The first storyteller in my life was my maternal grandmother, who was born in 1873 and was a pupil teacher to begin with, and then a certificated teacher, and spent her life until she retired in 1933 as a junior school teacher. And she was the eldest of three. Both her other sisters were teachers, and she was the survivor. She was the daughter of a self-taught man who I dimly remember, my great-great-grandfather. He was an extraordinary man. He was technically a paper finisher, but he had taught himself to become some kind of omniscient being. That's how I remember him. Anyway, he would talk about anything. I knew him briefly. He died at the age of 92. So that was the background to my grandmother, which meant that my grandmother, the teacher, inherited from her two sister teachers their libraries and her father's library. And we're sitting in the middle of it now, along with a lot of other books which I've acquired. This meant that my grandmother had access to large numbers of retellings of folk tales and fairy tales, especially Andrew Lang. But she had a genius, which I didn't recognise at the time. She would take the material, and by reading it over and over in class, she taught herself to be a storyteller. Until in the end, I don't think it was conscious, she would discard the text. I was an only child, and my grandmother was the main influence in my life, because my cousins seemed not to be interested in fairy tales. I was. I can't explain why. I was also a very sickly child, so I was alone in bed for more than half my primary school years, on and off. And I had my grandmother's cumulative library to read, and she would come and tell me stories. And that seemed to me to be perfectly normal. So when I was at school, I found that I was surrounded by other children who didn't know the stories. and I used to avoid being bullied by talking my way out of it through telling fairy stories to my contemporaries. It wasn't out of any love of storytelling, it was out of self-preservation.
Mm.
But the point of that is that I was surrounded by the printed word and also in the presence of a grandmother who was a natural oral storyteller.
Mm. Mm. And what about the Sleeping King? I mean, that's a story that's recurs across your books and a story that you mention often in your lectures and seems to be such a key story for here. Like, where did you first encounter that?
The Legend of Alderley is the local version of the sleeping hero.
Yeah.
That I first met. And I met it in two forms. The first time I met it, it was told to me by my mother, who was not a local woman.
Right.
And she was drawing on 19th century ornate versions of it that were the result of the Stanley family trying to make their land appear to be Arthurian. But the real version, the version that made all the difference to my life, was told to me by my paternal grandfather, who was a smith. And I became aware of it by his repetition of the story. He would tell it in idle moments. I remember in particular the magic of the forge, the darkness and the glow of the fire. That's an obvious focus for storytelling.
Mm.
But he would also tell it to me when we were in his garden, which was at the foot of the scarp of Alderley Edge, where the legend is set. And we'd be pulling rhubarb and he would tell the story. Now, he told it straight. There was no romanticism in it at all. There was no King Arthur. There was no wizard. Because the basic plot is mortal becomes involved with the immortal underground through the mediation of an intermediary, in this case, as he told it, an old chap. The way that my grandfather described this story, the legend, was as a piece of history. And especially when we were in his garden, he would be able to point from the garden to features in the landscape. And I don't know why he told it so often to me. Often in my memory, it may have only been perhaps three times in the whole of my life,
mm.
I don't know. But I do know, instinctively, that I didn't question it. I never said, "Grandad, is that true?"
Mm.
Because something in me made me not do that. I know intuitively that if I'd questioned it, he would have thought that he had chosen the wrong child or the wrong moment.
Mm.
It was his story. And it was only later that something very extraordinary happened. I was the first member of the family, and they'd been living in the same spot since at least 1592. I was the first to go through formal education. If that hadn't happened, that story would have been lost. It would have just become the normal Arthurian story,
mm-hmm.
of 19th century romanticism. But because I had the wonderful experience of my grandfather telling it to me when I was a child, probably about 4 or 5, when it started. Then coming to it as a formally educated classicist, I realized that there were anomalies in the story. He was telling the story about a square mile of the land that he knew best, and within it there were anomalies. And by, as a young adult, pursuing the anomalies, I discovered something that led to Alderley Edge being the oldest dated metalworking site in England. In other words, embedded in that story as anomalies were clues to the early Bronze Age. In 2016, Michael Wood, the historian, quite independently took it back to the Iron Age. So for me, it justifies, and they're not my words, one of my closest friends was a great academic, and he said that my experience went some way to justify the education of the lower orders. I came to storytelling from two directions. My grandmother and her father's library, and her oral storytelling as a teacher, and through being embedded in a local legend. And it's important to use a precise definition here. A legend is a fanciful tale associated with a real place that is believed by the people that live there to be true. So I had a bowl of riches.
You did. We lived, when I was a child, we lived in Cwmbran, and we would drive over Cat's Ash Hill, which is between Newport and Cwmbran, into Caerleon. And as we drove over Cat's Ash Hill, my father at the wheel would always say, of course, King Arthur's under here in a cave, covered in cobwebs. And one day he'll emerge when Wales is in danger and will return. And I grew up with that story and that sense of that hill being mysterious, clambered over that hill a lot in search of something. And I always understood it to be a story about, for the Welsh, about a golden age, you know, the sense that there was a time when we were greater than we are now, and that there is always the potential for a return to that greatness.
Well, I have a different reading of it which overlaps, and the word there is potential, because I think that story, that legend, has driven me all through my adult life, because as I discovered that the story of the hero under the hill awaiting the time of greatest peril was almost pan-Indo-European.
Yeah.
I became obsessed by it intellectually from an academic point of view, and it bore down on one question in particular. And the question does not apply to the legend of Alderley, but it is very common for the mortal to be given the power to wake the sleeping hero and to go through the various stages of drawing a sword and almost blowing a horn, but always stopping and saying, in effect, sleep you on.
Yeah.
And that's what pursued me. Why is it essential for the hero never to wake? And what I think it is that the hero is hope. Or if you like, potential. And if we use our last ace, there is no future.
There's nothing left.
And I've got an actual historical parallel to that. A friend of mine was in the Warsaw ghetto as a small girl. And the chance came to walk out of the ghetto. She was allowed to carry one object, and she took her doll. Outside the ghetto, there were Polish children waiting, and she swapped her doll for a stale crust of bread. The next 5 years, she had an extraordinary life. She was in camps in Russia. She was thrown about Europe and ended up in 1945 in a displaced persons camp in Egypt with one possession, a crust of stale bread. And I asked her why, and she said she knew that if she ate the crust of bread, she probably would not survive, but if she kept the crust of bread, it would always be there. And that was a moment of shock for me. I realised she was talking about the sleeping hero.
In The Voice That Thunders, there's a passage about a friend of yours called Albin.
Albin, yes.
And you describe how during the war he was a very gifted artist. And
I'll need to lead in, because
absolutely.
The beginning is a folk tale. Albin was born in Danzig. He was bilingual Polish, German, and in 1939, as an art student, he was on a student's tour when the war broke out, and he rushed home to die for Poland. He almost reached his hometown when in the forest he was met by somebody who knew him and told him that he must not go any further because his friends had in the small community, they had removed from the church registers the names of everybody that was not at that moment in the village.
Right.
So he, Albin, was not recorded in the village and was told to disappear. He turned round and went back into the forest and walked straight into a group of German soldiers who were looking for Poles to shoot. But because he was bilingual and convincing, he was offered the choice inside his own head of either dying for Poland now without having done anything, or serving the Reich. And this resulted in his spending 2 winters outside Stalingrad, which was the worst experience for any German soldier in that war. And the first year he was in, his artistic skills were used to draw pin-ups for the barrack room. And that was that. Then the first winter started to bite, and the Germans were suffering as much as the Russians were. and he was commanded to draw pornography. The second winter, when they were eating anything they could, rats, dead animals, cannibalism happened. They were eating their own belts. They were starving and they were becoming delirious. And Albin was then commanded to draw witches, giants, ogres, creatures of folklore, usually malevolent ones. And that was all that he was asked to draw. Those men who were dying were forced back deep into their unconscious souls. And they simply wanted the images of the imagination.
I'm fascinated by why they wanted those images above all other images in that moment of extremeness. I've been reading Primo Levi and also a book by Viktor Frankl called Man's Search for Meaning. He was also in a concentration camp. And both of them say broadly the same thing, which is that in that extremists, some people became animals and some people didn't. Some people managed to transcend the circumstances in which they found themselves. And there are accounts of people gathering of an evening to tell stories, clandestine gatherings where storytelling took place. And it reminded me, when I was rereading Strandloper, and also your account of the writing of Strandloper in The Voice That Thunders, of the passage across the sea to Australia and people telling stories in the darkness there.
Well, I wasn't making that up.
No.
And it brings me directly to a high horse that I'm going to ride.
Ride away.
Without arguing about archetypes as a reality or not, but just using them as a reference point, whether or not you're a Jungian doesn't matter. But it does seem to me that there are basic images deep in the human psyche that we touch upon daily and draw upon in crisis. And they are, of course, the undercurrent of folklore, folk tale, and fairy tale. And in my lifetime, my childhood experience was that fairy tales were pretty pictures with stories badly told in cheap books by people that couldn't write and were not qualified to tell these stories. Although I did not rationalise it that way, I felt that these cheap books with their stories in them were very much the inferior of the real stories that I heard from my grandmother.
Mm.
Now I get cross when I see that publishers are publishing the traditional fairy tales told by bankable names.
Mm.
I'm not qualified to say much more than that, but it does seem as though there is not, in the publishing world, a true understanding of the nature of folklore. But folklore is something that we inherit with every embryo that develops into a human being.
Mm.
It's part of us. So I don't think ultimately it will be at risk. It will go through different phases. And I notice that some of the better films, especially science fiction films, have within them, if they're good, archetypal elements and themes. If they're brought to the front so that you can throw the gods together and you have Thor fighting Odin in glorious technicolor, it doesn't work. Because the storytellers are not qualified to tell the story. It's as if these basic and most important stories that we have, far more important than any novel, are seen to be just there for anybody to kick around. They're not. I think it was the Industrial Revolution that broke the mystery. If you go to less developed cultures, you have to serve 20 years before you're allowed to say anything.
It's an interesting question for me as a storyteller.
I have had, Alan, why don't you do X fairy tales?
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to. I have done fairy tale collections. I have done folk tale collections, but only when I felt they were ready and I was ready. It's something I can't get across to editors, which is, but they say, but you produce these very good books. More, you know more. And I say, yes, but they're not mine at the moment.
As a storyteller, I must express an uncomfortable fellow feeling with your publishers there, because I would love you to publish another collection of stories. But if they're not there for you, they're not for you. But what you said, in other cultures, you said someone trains for 20 years before they can stand up in front of an audience. And here we are now in a time when there are such things in Britain as professional storytellers who travel from place to place, telling traditional stories and creating programmes which they hope will draw an audience, and so trying to tell some of the most complex and challenging stories that we have. How would one qualify to be able to tell, say, the theft of Persephone? How would one reach a point where one is able to tell that story, do you think?
I think, but I don't know, that there are two elements required. First of all, there is the unteachable. There is the basic personality that is capable of becoming a storyteller.
Mm.
And the other is one of total immersion over a long period of time in Persephone and all the rest, so that you see Persephone in perspective.
In a wider context. I often wonder if the Sleeping Beauty is Persephone. The moment where she is wakened and life resumes in the whole palace and things begin to grow again is Persephone returning to the world from Hades down below.
If you can make it that, it's true. No, I'm serious. Mm. If you can make it that, it's true. But if you are going to sit round the table in a publisher's office and have executives throwing motifs around, then you're sunk.
You said once in a lecture, which I haven't been able to track down since, that behind many stories there is a human who is offered the chance to exchange places with the divine and refuses and is destroyed. Does that ring a bell with you? Is that a familiar?
Yes.
Yeah.
Where did it come from? Can you give me more context? Because I've pondered it for years.
I don't know where it came from. It's been there, I feel, all my life. But of course, I wasn't intellectually capable of being as sophisticated as that, probably before the age of 20. But I don't know. What I do know is in the real world, if people become aware of a gift and suppress it, then psychologically they are at great risk. And their energies become negative and destructive of others. An example which is very common, and now we're moving into sociology, and the movement is quite smooth for me. The best example of that is what is known in psychological terms as the narcissistic parent, the parent that must make the child live the life that they, the parent, feel they should have lived themselves. And as long as the child goes along with that, it's a wonderful relationship. The moment the child starts to develop a separate mind and a separate being, then there's crisis. If the child is not strong enough, the child goes under. If the child is strong enough, the benevolent parent becomes the destroyer.
I've always thought of it, since I heard you say it, in relation to folk tales, encounters with the other people, the good people, the fairies. I thought about it in relation to the story that's very close to where I live, of Llynvan Bach, for example, which you tell in Bag of Moonshine as Belene of the Lake, where the young man sees a woman from the other world on the surface of the water and coaxes her from her world to his, and she sets the embargo, which of course contravenes, and she leaves him. And you know, some good comes of it because the sons become physicians, but he himself is lost afterwards. He can never reunite with her. And I saw that template that you described in that story and in so many other stories of encounters with the other world.
I've met it in my straightforward, boring personal life. I was educated to be, and I revelled in it, an academic.
Yeah.
When it became apparent to me, it was a Damascene Road moment, but I know that it must have been coming along for quite a while before then, that I wasn't going to spend my life examining the merits of various Greek texts. But I had to go out and do something about it myself.
Yeah.
I was terrified.
Right.
Absolutely terrified. But within a few hours of that realization, my view of the road that I travelled along up to that moment changed completely, and it became easy. It was not a decision anymore. It was not a problem. It was a recognition of something. I had been travelling to this point all my life and being prepared for it by myself and others. That is, I was selecting all from everything that was happening as I was growing up, the little bits and pieces, the tesserae that would go to make the mosaic, or the fragments of energy that would come together to enable me to go down that road. It is a mystery, and I'm not making more of it than that. I don't fully understand it. I don't understand it but I am equally vehement that it should not be made into anything mystical. It's part of natural human process. And perhaps it is made something special nowadays in a way that it should not be, is perhaps, again, the result of the Industrial Revolution and the Puritan ethic. I don't like theorising, so I'll make this into a concrete story. When I decided that I had to tell the world being my immediate family and the people of my community, that I was not going to be an academic, that I had to try to write, and I didn't know that I could. The universal reaction from well-meaning people who had my best interests at heart was, do it as a hobby. Do it in the holidays. Wait until you retire. A complete inability, and I'm not blaming anybody for it, because it is a strange experience, a complete inability to recognise the obligation which, once seen, is ignored at your peril. It's not power. It's service to something else.
You don't want to be Mr. Cal, so you won't be drawn on what it's service to.
No, I won't be.
Okay.
Because I don't know. I have many friends, and some of my closest friends, my very closest friends, are priests in different religions. And the one thing that they have in common in our friendship is that, with one exception, they have all said, but you're so obviously one of us, why don't you become a rabbi, a minister? And I say, no, I have no faith, I have no belief. And that frightens them, that somebody can see what they see and stand aside. Mm. But if I'm forced to it, and you are forcing me to it, I would say, for some people, the job is to be empathetic, sympathetic, and to stand aside and look. So, in the broadest sense, there is no difference between folklore, fairy tale, and religion.
Mm. Mm.
What they share is spirituality at the deepest level.
Mm. Here's me travelling Britain, presenting myself as first and foremost an entertainer, whereas actually I have this subtext. I suppose it might be analogous with your novels too. I feel there's something I want to say through the stories, or find some way of expressing something inexpressible through the stories, but I have to present myself as entertainment in order for it to be acceptable.
Well, that to me is self-evident and obvious, and the clearest one that would make sense to the largest number of people is that the New Testament says more through parables than if it did through a theological argument.
Yeah.
For instance, let's see if I can improvise. It's not my world. It's not very interesting to say to an audience, listen to me, I want to tell you about the effect of proximity to the dead upon the growth of the human psyche, I think you'd lose the audience. If you say there was a man dwelt by a churchyard,
yeah,
you've got them.
I used to have a minister, a Methodist minister, used to walk across the road to my primary school and tell us a parable. He'd tell us the parable for about 5 minutes, and then he'd tell us what we should be thinking about the parable for a good 10 minutes, to the point where the parable was stone dead by the time he'd finished.
You get a lot of that in the Victorian bad fairy tale telling.
You do. The challenge, I think, for a storyteller in my medium is to tell a story in such a way as you don't get in the way of the story. You present the story to the audience and then they all have their own conversation with it.
In my world of the written word, something I've come to argue with force is that if something is worth writing and is written well enough, then every reading is a creative act.
Mm-hmm.
Because the writer has written simply enough and clearly enough not to impose the personality of the writer upon the text, but intriguingly enough for the reader,
yeah,
to recognise something of themselves in the text,
yeah,
and to react with it and to create something that neither reader nor writer could individually have produced. And I've experienced it many, many times where somebody has come up to me and said, I can't get that out of my head. And I say, what? And they tell me. And for me, it was just a connecting sentence.
Yeah. I used to go out to a theatre and tell stories in a theatre in Hawaii. And the initial argument for my doing this, apart from the fact that it would be great fun, would be that I'd take cold, damp, dark stories to a hot, bright, dry climate. And a local woman who's connected with, a local Hawaiian woman who's connected with the native Hawaiian community in a big way, came to a performance where I told, I think, probably 8 stories. And she said, ah, yes, the respect for the elder story, thank you. And I had no idea which one out of the 8 stories I'd just told was the respect for the elder story.
That's really like trying to eat dehydrated potato. There's no life in it.
The Sleeping King, I remember I had a group of foreign teachers in front of me at some event or another. They'd come along to hear some Welsh stories, and I told the Sleeping King story, and I said afterwards, but of course there are versions of this from all over Europe, there are versions of this from, and I mentioned various countries, one of which was Germany, and a German teacher came up to me afterwards and said, we don't have that story. And I said, oh, well, I gathered that it's connected to Charlemagne. And she said, no, we don't have that story. We don't have that story. And she was absolutely vehement that they didn't have the story of this sleeping king and army waiting to return.
Well, Germany, I think, is in a historical mess in that area as a result of Hitler. If Hitler did one thing that is going to stick around for a long time, is that he killed a swastika. I had the only unpleasant experience of my life in Munich, in this area. I was there for the British Council, and it came to a moment where there were 4 writers on a platform, 3 of them German, and the other one was me. And the chairman was a German academic whose English was flawless, and he was very much aware of what developed. And the 3 Germans were talking about their books, not about the contents of their books. And I was getting it in translation. And then it was opened up to the audience. And I hadn't spoken all through the session. Nobody wanted me to. A question from the audience came, what is the function of folklore and mythology in the world today? And one of the Germans said, the only function of mythology is to further a political ideal. And the chairman came in like a lightning bolt and said, Alan Garner. And there I was. And I can guarantee you that what follows is verbatim. I thought, well, I cannot dodge this. So I said, I think Germany has suffered enough this century from that attitude. And the audience stood up and bayed for my blood. And I was hustled to the back. The meeting disintegrated. And then slightly off stage, I saw I was surrounded by tall, blonde young men. And I thought that my hour had come. But no, they were undergraduates and they wanted me to go on.
Yeah.
But the British Council representative who was responsible for my safety afterwards said he thought he wasn't going to get me out of that hall.
Mm.
And that would have been round about 1990.
So now, where we are now, when we are now, with the conversations in the cultural consciousness, what are the stories the storytellers need to be telling? What are the stories that we need to put out into the world?
I don't know. I think that's your job.
Yeah. I was looking for advice. I mean, I know the ones I want to tell, and I'm telling them with all the energy I have.
Well, I think that's your answer. Yeah. I think you know. You won't know consciously, but you'll know what works.
Yeah.
And you'll know what you want to tell. Yeah. And that's what you must tell. Everybody, whatever their medium, must tell the story that they want to tell, not the story that's commissioned.
Yeah.
Because the story that's commissioned may have been commissioned for a reason that is not right. This is guesswork rather than theory, and it's the immediate response to what we've been talking about. I think the storyteller is in the position of the moment and the immediacy of that moment in the unique meeting of people in the room now. And when you tell your story, it's had an effect. You may not be able to predict that effect. Then you go away, and at some time in the future, you can tell the story again to another audience. The same story, but it will not be the same story. You will have changed, it will have changed you, and the audience will be different. Now, for me, I am writing. I can't write for an audience, because I do not know the audience. I don't know you, the reader. So this may not be an eternal verity, but it's true for me. I have to write for me. And I started at 4:03 on Tuesday, the 4th of September, 1956. And on the spring equinox of 2011, yes, the spring equinox of 2011, at 11 o'clock in the morning, I finished a novel. And at that moment, I realised I'd finished, period. And that was quite a shock. And a few days later, I saw that I'd written 9 novels, each one in its turn being an original idea, something that I needed to get out of my system, something I needed to examine, a story I needed to tell. A story that pre-existed and had to come out through me. I would never claim that I'm a good writer, but I do claim that I'm a good piece of copper wire. And what I saw after finishing Boneland was that the 9 novels were all one story. And the metaphor I can come up with best for that is to say that I'd spent all that time since 1956, being the engine of a goods train, which kept having different trucks added to it, which contained different materials and were different colours, but they all ran on the same line and were being pulled by the same force and were joined together. And all that the engine was aware of was that it was getting harder. And that shook me, because then I thought, what on earth am I going to do with the rest of life? Is that it? Have I finished? And I had. I could see one arc of story, and I hadn't seen it coming, but having completed it, I could see it. And it doesn't matter if nobody else ever sees it. So I was left with an intellectual exercise in desperation. I thought, I've always dreaded, this is a neurosis, I've always dreaded not finishing something I'd seen start in my head. And that's always been true. I carried the manuscript, the unique manuscript of the Owl Service wherever I went, which is the most dangerous thing I could have done. This predates the computer, it predates word processing. It was longhand. Then it had to be typed up in a unique typescript. I was always afraid of not being able to live long enough to finish something I'd started. But with the end of Boneland, on the threshold of being 80, the thought of seriously undertaking something new, if anything emerged, and there was nothing, I saw I'd completed something. And since I tend to write a book a decade, it would be foolish to start writing my version of War and Peace. Mm. And I didn't know what to do. And then I had an idea, and it was purely an abstract idea. And that is it possible to write something which, at any point, if I was prevented from carrying on with it for any reason, it was complete? That was a simple inner intellectual challenge. But it led to remembering the work I was doing from 1996 to 2006 on the Alderley Edge Landscape Project, which was a complete investigation of Alderley Edge from the early Triassic geology of 145 million years ago up to modern-day footballers. Every aspect. But for me, the valuable part was the oral history, because that's something you can't go back and check on 10 years later. And I was involved in that. And what struck me soon after it began was I was speaking and talking and interviewing with my contemporaries, and we could all agree on events that we'd shared as a group of children. But then, the more we talked, the more I realised there were as many memories of what actually happened as there were people to remember it. So I pondered on that. And then at the end, there were a lot of oral offcuts of conversation that had not been recorded or had gone nowhere, and they all had their historical importance. And that's how I arrived at Where Shall We Run To?
Right.
Now, because the 9 novels all contain elements of let's say, spirituality from the basic magic of the first ones through to the deeper psychological implications. I'd always researched obsessively, because if you're going to open your palm to the reader and say, is there anything there, you better make sure that the palm is well constructed. So I have been all my life obsessional about placing the imagination in a physical reality. But here was another way of looking at humanity and history. Since I was talking with my contemporaries, and we all remembered the same thing but remembered it differently, I arrived at the idea of where shall we run to. I would tell, using my writerly skills, I would put together honestly and without fabrication my memories, but recognizing they were not history, they were memory.
No. Yeah.
And therefore I did no research, even where I could have done. And I became aware of a new form of vitality in the writing I'd not experienced before. I was not making it up. I was remembering. And I will be surprised if I'm not taken to task over aspects of it by people who say, I was there and it wasn't like that. That will prove to me that I've got it right. So, the storyteller has repeated moments. Each moment is unique, each retelling is unique, and should grow from the experience of all those retellings. The writer, in a given story, say a novel, writes it, and it goes out, and the writer has no real awareness of the effect of that telling, except there's enough evidence that comes back from people who are either enthusiastic out of pleasure or irritation to show that they have interpreted it their way. So that is the difference between the oral storyteller and the novelist. The novelist writes in isolation, pushes it out into the dark, and it's gone, and there's no control over it. The oral storyteller has the experience of the reaction, the feedback, and builds it in unconsciously into the future tellings. So it's an eternal present.
It's something that I found very appealing about storytelling when I began it, which is that everything I ever made was work in progress. That I never had to worry about it being complete and finished, because there was always... The analogy I came to was a transformation chase, that whenever I thought I was getting close to the story I was attempting to tell, it would shapeshift, and I'd have to accommodate by shapeshifting myself. Mm-hmm. And it would continue forever. I found that very appealing.
You hope to become the hen with the grain of corn that won't get away.
No, I hoped that the conversation between me and the story would continue and continue. If I ever became the hen and the story was the grain of corn, then I'd have to find something else to chase.
Yeah. So do you have, with your experience now, do you see a single theme that you prefer?
It's rebirth. It's over and over again, it's the central character going through an experience they think they can't survive, an extreme experience which they think they can't survive, and emerging out the other side transformed. That's the story I keep telling over and over and over again.
Well, the arc of stories that I saw was death.
In the stories that I told?
No, me.
Oh, yeah, in yours.
And acceptance.
Mm. When did you come to that realisation?
After I'd finished Bonehen. Mm. I can see now that the the really crucial one, from my point of view, I can't evaluate literary merit, was the 12 years of Strandloper. Mm. Because there I was fortunate in having access to the Australian Aboriginal mind through a European anthropologist who had become an elder. It was a woman, and she was so highly elevated that she could negotiate not only in women's business but in men's business. And yet she was an English academic. And she said to me that I could do it. She knew I could do it. But I'd have to stop asking questions. And I remember her saying very clearly, you can forget Greece and Rome if you don't listen. And the word she used was obey, but it wasn't a Dalek type of obey. She said, what she was saying was, if you don't let go and trust me that you will not fall, because you're going to have to spiritually and intellectually and mentally completely rewire your brain for a period, it won't go wrong. But if you try to stand aside and say what's happening, it'll go, you'll blow it. And that exercise was really life-changing for me. I didn't go bush, but I was able to switch off Greece and Rome for the period required. Everything that we think of as the intellect. Mm. And to go with a completely different expression of the human spirit and then bring it back.
And when you came back, when you emerged out the other side of that, were you changed?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, you didn't slot back to Greece and Rome entirely. No.
I was able, in a proper sense, to live with both, to integrate. So yes, you're equally valid. One is not superior to the other.
No.
And that was a wonderful lesson.
And yet you're still not able to write a book of folk tales for us, despite that.
Oh, it's worse, because all my Western, clever, academically trained, rational mind with its ability to reason itself out of everything, it's all gone adrift. Because I have one of my closest friends is a particle physicist, and he helped me a lot with Boneland. And in one of our long evening conversations, I nearly finished Boneland. It's the part that I enjoy very much, talking to people who are in a completely different discipline and finding the meeting points.
Mm, yeah.
Which the two of us have called Operation Melting Snow, because C.P. Snow and his two cultures we don't believe in. So when you deal with the cosmology of Jodrell Bank and the particle physics of CERN, in the two directions, and you find out it's the same story, and nothing that I can make up is as wild as what they're finding. I remember on this occasion, the friend was asking me, how do you write? You know, he was curious about the ability to come out of nowhere with an idea, which to him was a bigger mystery than it was for me. And so we're having these wild talks, and I said, for the purpose of a novel, would it be possible for time to reverse and go backwards? And he said, I've seen it happen. And we were off. And the next day, we were walking across an Iron Age hill fort in Huddersfield. And we talked the night before, and unsuccessfully, I had not been able to communicate how the ideas for a book come together. That they're not sought, they're given. That's a subjective experience. And he told me a local anecdote. And I said, do you remember last night I said this? He said, yes. I said, well, you've just given me the other half. He said, what? I said, there's a novel. He said, what is it? I said, I don't know. So that was 5 years ago. That was 2013. And just a few weeks after finishing and getting rid of my duties to Where Shall We Run To, the third element came into my mind. And I'm stuck. I've got a novel. And I've written the first chapter, or rather the first chapter's written me, that's how it feels like.
Yeah.
And it's perfect. I know how it ends, the whole thing, but I don't know what happens next, and I don't know how far away the end is.
Yeah.
So I'm stuck. I can't die yet. That's what Griselda was referring to when I said, she said, if you write something, don't finish it. That's another example. One of the things I value most out of my life and the way that I've lived it and what that life has given me is the need to recognise and to acknowledge the cosmic joke. Trickster rules. And you can't get away from it, thank God.